This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, February 8th, 2014. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and our topic for today is Impeach Obama Before Thermonuclear War Starts in Ukraine. Now, I'll tell you right off the bat, this is the slogan on a banner that was on Capitol Hill on, I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday this week. It was actually midweek on Wednesday the 5th and got a lot of attention. And I'm very glad we have someone here who is regularly on the scene in Washington and likewise someone from Europe to discuss our situation, because they are on the front lines of our mobilization that we should succeed in impeaching Obama and definitely stopping the countdown to thermonuclear war. Now, I have with me here live in the studio Alicia Serratani. Welcome, Alicia.
Thank you, Marcia. Good to be here.
And she was the one that was on site with that banner. I guess you could say she's leading, that you've heard of truth squads. I guess she's leading a reality squad. And likewise, in Europe, I welcome from Germany, Roger Moore. Welcome, Roger.
Good evening from Wiesbaden.
Yes, it's evening there, and we're glad to have you. And Roger, who is very much involved in many, many things, happens to have been in Strasbourg this week at a meeting of the European Parliament, or at least the Foreign Affairs subsection of that. We're going to hear more about it, because that's the point. We are... our guests are going to be speaking about the responses they're forcing among lawmakers, about their sense of how to understand this pass we've got ourselves into in terms of civilization, because the situation is that it turns out, as it has come to be, that Ukraine, the nation of Ukraine, is the arena. It's center stage for a showdown, historic showdown, not just of a matter of Ukraine, Russia, or even the European Union or the geopolitical surrounding area, but for the entire world, over 7 billion people. Because what's lined up here is, on one side, the forces completely against humanity and the development of humanity, which are best called the kind of neo or modern British Empire or Anglo-Dutch Empire, literally the imperial, oligarchical, stinking, we could get into that more in a bit, gang that's pushing for strife, wars, and destruction of the means of existence of nations and peoples versus almost exclusively in Eurasia, activation on behalf of development, because you see in the largest area of Eurasia, that is Russia, China, parts of India, and elsewise, you see actual moves for development in terms of science, culture, and physical means for expanding people's relative potential for more and more population, like going into outer space is our frontier, like developing high-speed rail, new sources of water, dams, water management, enhancing the planet. I hope people, this is a small digression, I hope, look for the photograph that was publicized by NASA just on February 7th, of the planet Earth from Mars. It's stunning. And it kind of puts you in the right mindset of how we should be looking at what we're doing here on the Earth, is that man's dominion is the universe. So we're in a showdown of empire versus humanity. And our problem is, we can get in this program some on how evil is the evil empire. But a lot of our humanity is really beaten down, and they need picked up, they need kicked in the butt, they need induced, they need loved up, they need whatever they need to do to make sure we stop this countdown to war, stop the dynamics behind it, which is really a breakdown of the economic monetarist system of the West, you could say, and get some action. Now, what I want to do is say two things, and then we want to have the situation we're in described in the words of Lyndon LaRouche, who has been sounding the alarm. He's 91 years old. He's writing. He's speaking. He's kicking and screaming that we can succeed, but we have to act. And on Monday, that would be February 3rd, for the Weekly Policy Committee video discussion by the LaRouche Political Action Committee, we have a clip from that. It's about 8 minutes, and in just a second, we're going to hear that, and then we're going to open the discussion with Roger and Alicia. I will say right now is look, this is our pitch here in the sense that you can find in writing and video what you need about this countdown to war and what we need to do to stop it on a page on LaRouchePAC.com. Alicia, what the exact name will be clear. I can't remember it, but if you just look there, right?
Of the page?
Yeah.
Yeah, LaRouchePAC.com. It's right on the front page. You'll see it's a rotating banner, Ukraine, Battle for Sovereignty, and it has the fact sheet that we've been getting out and all of the breaking news and background on how this is a battleground bringing into major forces and into confrontation with one another.
Right, because in a minute you'll hear literally about the circulation we're doing of this fact sheet, the circulation of, in particular, a leaflet-style statement, and all the rest. And likewise, on LaRouchePAC.com, where you're listening to us right now, we have on the home website, the hot news column on the right, and other things that are keeping you up to date. So what we have here is from February 3rd, an 8-minute clip of Lyndon LaRouche summarizing the situation where we're at, and then we'll go right into the discussion.
What I've been saying since January 1st is that we're now in a countdown toward a thermonuclear war. What we're in now is just provocations against Russia to try to set up a situation which will trigger a Russian response of the type they want, and then they will immediately launch thermonuclear war. Now, my time scale was saying, well, by the 1st of March, we are already at that time, if not earlier, we are on the verge of actual thermonuclear mutual extermination. Because if you read what the policies have been stated from the United States and elsewhere and from Russia, the point is they've recognized that there's no advantage in waiting to do the second blow against either. They're all going to go together virtually simultaneously. Now, when you consider what that means, putting everything into a simultaneous assault, which is what the United States is stuck with right now is the only option for it, from a military standpoint. You have to go with pretty much everything you've got, mm-hmm. and you have to do it all right up front. Because the way these things hit, they hit after each other.
Right.
So it's bang, 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 bang. And therefore, that's what you're up against. So therefore, my estimate is this thing is got to be brought to some kind of a conclusion. Either avoidance of war or going to war is going to be about the 1st of March, somewhere in that vicinity. It has to be that way, because otherwise other things are going to start kicking in as well. And what they have to fear, Washington, really London is orchestrating this, they're not Washington. But as long as Washington is in that case of the grip of the British on this one, I think the time for a reaction against such a war is wearing out. In other words, if the so-called nominal Obama administration, he's just a joke. He's not really, he does not make the decisions. He mouths, echoes whatever they tell him from London. He never was able to think. He wouldn't even run for president unless London had come with his woman and come in and recruited him to become a presidential candidate. He would have never become a presidential candidate without that operation. It was a British operation run from London. So the British Empire is the one that's steering this thing. Obama's nothing but a stooge. And people have to understand that. Most Americans refuse to face the fact that this guy is a stooge. But Wall Street is there too. And Wall Street is London. Wall Street is the British Empire. So it's the British Empire that's orchestrating this thing. And a lot of dumb Americans especially Republicans. The Republicans are the worst of this thing, because they have an absolutely insane agenda. It's almost as bad as that of their, the guy who pulled a stunt this past weekend. And this guy should be thrown out of office by the Republicans. He shouldn't even bother letting anybody else throw him out. They could throw him out of the roster. He did something an attack on Bill Clinton, which was clinically insane for any Republican to do. So that's the situation we're in. And therefore, very soon, if somebody tries to keep this operation going inside the United States, they're going to get a reaction. Mm-hmm. And what they're counting on is that they will be able to launch the war, the thermonuclear war, internationally, before people get so sick of Obama that they throw him out. If Obama were to be thrown out of office, which is the only intelligent purpose of any leading figure, I say, throw this bum out of office now, and you may save the civilization, including the people of the United States. If you guys don't have the guts to throw this bastard out, then our people don't deserve to live, in a sense. They haven't the cowardice, they don't have the leadership which will enable them to continue to live, because they're simple fools. Because they have, just because they are ignorant, which they are, they didn't have to be ignorant, they chose to be ignorant. Or their parents chose them how to be ignorant. Because my generation would never have waited this long. They'd have thrown them out. But the point is, we've gone through successive generations since World War I, World War II, and what could have been World War III if Kennedy hadn't prevented it.
Right.
And that's where we are. And the problem is, you've got a bunch of lame brains out there. You cannot go to popular opinion to get popular opinion to come out and make a gesture of protest, because popular opinion doesn't have the brains anymore to do that. You have a strong minority of people, and actually a majority, who don't like Obama, don't want any part of him. They want him thrown out. They haven't got the guts to do it. I do. Mm-hmm. They don't. So it's my responsibility, since I have the guts to do it. Even my fellow Americans who are patriots don't have the guts right now to do it. They don't have the guts to save their own life. They don't save civilization. But it's understandable. It's only people who are leaders like me who really have the guts to do this. And there I have to kick and push to try to get some brains showing up among some of our people. They don't have the guts to do it. I do. And I think in this case, I have an advantage at my age, because I have nothing to lose except for us to win. And that's the way you have to look at this. We're at a point where within this month, maybe even earlier than immediately, it can happen very quickly. You're dealing with a detonation of a global world war, a simultaneously global world war, not like World War I or World War II, simultaneously global. And everybody on both sides agree. They cannot do a step-by-step operation. They will either come to provocations to ignite the war, but they won't do a step-by-step war anymore. This will be an instant global warfare, which, if you consider the weaponry involved, means that the whole world will go through it in a shortened period of time, about an hour and a half at most, before the entire planet is enveloped by the effects of this. And therefore, you have to do anything. Throw this president out of office now. And just to rehearse that, you should throw Rand Paul out of office for making the biggest ass of himself that anyone.
That might be the end of the clip, I think, and that's all right, too. You see at the end there, in case you were wondering who Mr. LaRouche was referring to earlier on, Senator Rand Paul is kind of conducting a pea-brain, keyhole approach to history, peep show, by that he's continuing that even after this week. We don't have to discuss it more here, but after last weekend when he wants to make an issue of the impeachment operation against Bill Clinton as a thing in itself instead of an absolutely staged, conducted, rotten intervention by enemies of the United States, the British enemies of the United States against the American presidency. So, but back to the, and so Ron Paul, instead of seeing the whole picture, is activating on this pathetic way. But the whole picture now, again, is let me recap one thing. It was last fall when the nation of Ukraine, which celebrated its over 20 years, its independence in 1990-91, said last fall it did not want to align itself in an association agreement with the European Union. The European Union is clearly going down the tubes, and it was instead de facto going to align with the development movement on Eurasia. It made the elected government of Ukraine made arrangements with Russia for energy arrangements, other intention for nuclear power plants, and bang, in recent weeks and months, the London European Union Obama Empire operation has activated in the streets with mob violence, working with Nazis, and that's what's Nazi operations, gangs, terrorism against this nation. But it's in the heart of, right there in the encirclement of Russia, and that's what Mr. LaRouche was referring to. That's what's in our fact sheet that started to be circulated on the 3rd of February in Washington. So, Alicia, you've been on the scene the whole time. And in effect, what I think Mr. LaRouche or other people have sometimes said, what we need is a preemptive peace, and you've been slanging it out on Capitol Hill. What do you want to say about the situation as you see it right now?
Well, to begin with, you know, for us to come in and wage the campaign we did this week with the fact sheet on what the forces are involved in the, you know, so-called Ukrainian opposition, the effectiveness and I think the reverberation that we've had, which I can go into some detail on, I think should be seen in the context that we have really established ourselves as an institution in Washington, particularly in the last year and a half, 2 years, where we've established a very high level, very highly visible presence on the House and Senate side, warning the Congress and trying to bring them into a larger strategic picture of what's developing in the country and around the world versus the tactics that they often get caught up into. And this is particularly on the issue of Glass-Steagall, the collapse of the financial system, and the tensions that are arising, which we are seeing in an acute form now with this war danger, which is what the point Mr. LaRouche is making, that the source of this really is a strategic showdown of East versus West, actually more specifically, empire versus sovereign nations. And because we are, you know, as an institution on Capitol Hill, our banner this week, as you mentioned in the beginning, said, impeach Obama before thermonuclear World War III begins in Ukraine. And besides the text of that, we had a map of Europe, and we had the NATO nations highlighted and the BMD systems current and planned on the map, and that was a very effective way of just demonstrating for people, hey, this is what's actually going on. This isn't just about Ukraine, and that was the fight we've been trying to try to give the Congress members a sense of. The overall strategy, because listeners should remember, I mean, the what happened in Syria this last summer is still a reference point for these guys. They know that that was never actually resolved. Yes, we didn't go into Syria with military force, but the danger, the different players involved, the violation of international law that this president's been involved in for several years now, these are all still things on the table, and they will continue to be while he's in the presidency. So when they see this situation with Ukraine breaking, the reactions we got after getting out, I don't know, probably 400 fact sheets immediately on Capitol Hill, we talked to probably up to 60 or 70 members directly, the reactions we were getting from them was, number one, give us what you've got. Not because, you know, we know it's good news, but we trust you guys. You guys have been here. You've given us the picture. And a lot of them just need a map. They need a way to understand what's happening in Ukraine. A lot of the members of Congress know that it's bigger than a disagreement between two factions, between East versus West Ukraine, but they don't know exactly what factors are at play. So we, after giving, you know, some of these Congress members, after having given them the fact sheet, one congressman read it immediately and came back in an hour and wanted to discuss it with us and say, can you specify this? Can you specify that? He was really disturbed. You know, no one was thanking us because they said, oh, great, this clears it up. They're saying, you know, they were thanking us for a certain a sober analysis of what was going on. But we got an incredible amount of traction from these members of Congress because they're being fed a lot of garbage. And the American people see that. Some of these Congress members come out and say the craziest things. Yes, we should, you know, run sanctions on Iran and disrupt these peace processes. Yes, we should go intervene in Syria. Yes, we should go militarily intervene in Ukraine. You know, they say all kinds of things. But those really are fringe members. The majority of members of Congress really do want to understand what's happening, and we found that out this week. We had a really explosive response. But to clarify, that doesn't necessarily mean that when push comes to shove, and if these guys get scared, they won't back a 100% coup in Ukraine. We still have a lot of work to do. There's a lot at stake. Some of these guys understand that. A few of them even understand that it's tied to the financial collapse of the transatlantic, although that's a stretch for some of them. But they get that it's big. They get that it's bigger than Ukraine, and they understand. I mean, one Congress member told us directly, look, you know, and this is typical of Congress, look, whether there are Nazi factions in the opposition or not, I just don't think we should be intervening there. It's not our business to intervene. So some of them get it in a limited way. What they're prepared to do remains to be seen, and that continues to be our job. I mean, we've got a lot of things cooking on Capitol Hill. Listeners know, people know, we've got Glass-Steagall, we've got a certain amount of momentum on unveiling the role of the Saudi and British sponsorship of global terrorism, and these things all relate, because as Mr. LaRouche said recently, I think he said it Thursday evening, there are no independent events happening on the planet right now. You're dealing with a global system, global factors. And that's the real challenge with Congress. You would think, as members of a federal government, that they would be able to think big, but they really can't. And it takes a lot of effort to get them to play on the real stage of history. So I'll stop there. There's more to be said, but that's sort of a rundown of the responses we've gotten so far.
Right.
I'd like to say something, Marcia. My area of work doesn't put me so much in contact with the direct population, but I have had over the recent period numerous things. I can just report on some of that. In the last 6 weeks, I have had discussions. Some of them were more intense. Some were in context of public events with four German military officers. From the rank of brigadier general on up to top-level generals. These were two of them were active duty. One of them was, in fact, is in a very important position as in the central command of the German military forces. The other two are retired, but one of the retired was a very high-ranking German officer in the strategic headquarters of NATO up near Brussels. All of those discussions, irrespective of some of the details about Ukraine, they weren't necessarily of the opinion that we're going for nuclear war or weren't making comments on Ukraine per se. But the central theme of all those discussions from these officers to retire to active duty was we are getting it very, very wrong with the Russians. Mm-hmm. And they are very, very worried about that. One thing one has to understand is that in a way that is not equivalent to U.S. military dealings with Chinese officers or with Russian military people, there's a lot of exchanges that go on in various contexts. There's a certain level of respect, and I've experienced this over the 33 years I've been here in Germany as an American, between German military people and Russian military people. And the German military people have a good sense of the thinking of Russians when it comes to issues that threaten the existence of Russia coming out of the experiences of World War II, where the main fighting was between the German army, the Wehrmacht, and the Red Army. So that's one thing. This has not been expressed in public debates or anything like that. That's not the nature of these people. But it's one of the factors that's often led to, for instance, the fact that Germany didn't go along with the coalition of the willing in this cooked-up war in Iraq. They did go in because Victoria Nuland, who was Dick Cheney's advisor and who spreads cookies out in Kiev and says fuck the EU in telephone calls with the U.S. ambassador in Kiev, that in that case, Germany went in under the NATO, I believe it's Article 5 clause of a mutual act of defense, the invasion of Afghanistan, and that's why the German military is in Afghanistan. But in general, there is a very strong sentiment that this, and it's expressed also from the German Industry Association here, the East Committee of the German Industry. There's several hundred German companies that are active, sometimes in just simple trade, but also in building up factories or in contracts with some of the bigger industrial combines in Ukraine with policies of technology transfer as business. Nothing dramatic. They're also very active in that respect, also vis-a-vis Russia, and have a sense of what the potential could be for Western Europe with the Eurasian economic development perspective and the wish of Russia to modernize itself. So that overlaps with some reality thinking on the side of at least some of the strategic thinkers within Germany. The other thing is I was last Wednesday at the European Parliament. Now, the European Parliament, they meet every couple of weeks, either in Brussels in some big modern glassy building or down in Strasbourg in a building that's more like a big chicken coop or a pig factory. I mean, it's a wild complex. The European Parliament is not really a legislative body, but it's 800 people elected, I think, every 4 years from all of the 28 or so European Union countries. And there, the reason we were there is we've been in contact with one. we know many people, but we knew one who seemed to have some guts, and that's an Italian, Pino Arlacchi. We'll be doing some interviews with him. And Pino Arlacchi is he's a European member, Parliament member from Italy, but he in an insane session where they rubber stamped, they had a sense of the European Parliament, like the debate in the House of Representatives on the resolution on Ukraine. He was the one person. Other people kind of nibbled at the issue of what are we doing here? This is wrong. We can't go for sanctions. We're choosing sides, et cetera, et cetera. Some people even mentioned the right-wing extremist organizations, the Nazi organizations. But Pino Arlacchi got up and basically made a statement, and I'd like to just say it, because Pino Arlacchi is a former high-ranking UN official. He was the head of the United Nations Office on Narcotics Control, which then became the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime. His follow-up head of it was Antonio Maria Costa, who has done a lot of work with the Russians when he was the head of that office, trying to do things against the narcotics traffic coming out of Afghanistan. Pino Awlaki was the guy who got the Taliban to stop the opium production in Afghanistan for 1 year, but it was the only year where it stopped since the Mujahideen operations of the 1980s. And they actually stopped the opium planting, the poppy planting. That's who Pino Awlaki is. And in 2010, as a leading foreign policy person in the European Parliament, he worked with Viktor Ivanov in Russia to create, to design, and it was a relatively credible design, for a new West European, so EU policy with Russia on Afghanistan as a part of the preparations for the NATO troop pullout. So he knows the Russians. And here's what he had to say, and it was only 1 minute. These guys are only allowed to say 1 minute. It's got nothing to do with the parliament or anything reflecting sentiments in Europe. But what he said is, Mr. President, this is Pino Awlaki, I believe that the last debates on Ukraine show the need for a deep, deep review of our Eastern Partnership Project. My comment is, by the way, the Eastern Partnership Project was this effort of the EU to lock Ukraine into a disastrous free trade policy with the European Union. That's what that was rejected by them back in November. So it goes on. The major flaw of our Eastern policy is that it's anti-Russian. Is its anti-Russian Cold War profile. This policy should be redesigned with a view including Russia and not antagonizing a country which is not an enemy, because Russia is a part of Europe and should be treated accordingly. Another major blunder is our excessive interference in Ukrainian political affairs. Ukraine is not an EU protectorate. It is a sovereign country with a freely elected parliament, and I might add a freely elected president, whatever one thinks of him. We should stop to tell them what kind of government they should have, what kind of constitution they should adopt, and when and how to have political elections. It is not the European Union business to liberate Ukraine and to take sides in its political process. It is ridiculous to ask Russia to stop retaliatory measures against Ukraine at the same time the EU threatens sanctions if Ukraine does not follow what our agenda is. Thank you. And so he ended his intervention, and some of us clapped. We were in the audience in the visitors tribune. And it was reflective, I think, of what Diane Rohrabacher, the congressman from Orange County, and Alan Grayson from Florida did when they, interceded and drew out a serious discussion at the House, one of the Foreign Affairs subcommittees, or wherever it was they were preparing this resolution on the Ukraine. So these parallel things like this are going on. The only thing I would like to emphasize is to keep in mind, when we talk of these, in the fact sheet, we have the history going back to 1941 of Ukrainian fascists who were incorporated into the Hitler's invasion policy, Operation Barbarossa, which took place in June of 1941 against the Soviet Union. And Stefan Bandera's organizations and the second and third generations of that and the various little group of souls that are the 3,000 to 10,000 paramilitarily trained people who produced the provocations with the police, that produced the headlines so that the media could run this media distortion of all these, sort of hippie-like peaceful demonstrators in the 100,000 and getting beaten up by the police. Well, the actual fighting had nothing to do with the majority of the demonstrators. It had to do with these neo-Nazi paramilitary units going after the police, like in the front page of the new EIR edition, throwing Molotov cocktails and trying to cremate these people. And when the Russians look at that, they know their history. They know who these groups are. President Putin had the intelligence dossiers. This Ukraine operation was being planned at the same time as the Libya operation, at the same time as the plans to unleash an Israeli attack on Iran last year, all things that were stopped by the U.S. military and eventually the U.S. Congress last fall. But this was all going on with the Ukraine, all the preparations for what Sergei Glazyev called a coup d'etat. All of that was going on throughout last year. And what Putin said is at basically what they did in November to produce these confrontations and to prepare and to do a de facto a coup d'etat. He said that this was all prepared for the 2015 presidential election in Ukraine, but they moved it up. Now they moved it up and escalated this with the Vilnius meeting with the EU. Why? Because this became the flank against the potential collaboration between Russia and the United States that partially emerged around Syria and Iran after the U.S. military, starting from the chief of staff on down, from General Martin Dempsey on down into the retired military, into the appropriate congressional offices, and into the town hall meetings, when people said, no, we're not going into another war. And then Lavrov came in and said, here, I've got a peace offer. Let's dismantle the chemical weapons in Syria. And by the way, let's go to Geneva, too. And by the way, let's settle the problem with Iran. And then suddenly, relatively suddenly, this EU-Ukraine effort, you know, to take over Ukraine, becomes the flank to then try to disrupt this potential collaboration from what we're doing and associated people with us are doing, both in the military and hopefully more in the Congress, to work with the Russians. I think that's the preemptive peace policy. It needs the economic component, but it's the preemptive peace policy against the what is surely to be a strategic confrontation if the blood starts flowing in Ukraine. And there's no peace in Ukraine right now. Don't worry about the headlines that it seems quiet. Everything is like a tinderbox because it was pre-planned. The planning is still there. There's diplomatic things that go on, and there's meetings and this and that, and sanctions yes and sanctions no. The fundamental issue was to break up this country as a challenge to the Russians and set the stage for the strategic brinkmanship, nuclear brinkmanship. And, I wish I could report on more what's going on about it, but I think from my experience with both the German military and my colleagues' experience with sort of things that don't make headlines of politicians and people in industry, there is extremely, and I know it from my discussions with Swiss business people. Once a week I spend time calling up Swiss businessmen, and you always get a serious reaction when you give a clear-cut representation of the financial crisis and this danger that, not merely the danger, but the intention is to go for a conflict with the Russians and all what that means.
Yes, thanks. And I'll just say I've seen a report, this was earlier in this week, around February 4th, of the extensive circulation in Europe of this fact sheet and a related strategic initiative that Helga Zepp-LaRouche issued a call for a declaration for independence of those nations of the European Union, the ones that you were just describing send parliamentary members to Brussels or Strasbourg and just go through motions when what we need is reassertion of sovereignty and development. But I can say that I understand that colleagues of yours circulated this key material to really all nations, I mean, everywhere from Austria and Switzerland to Spain and Portugal to Greenland and Iceland, throughout Scandinavia, beginning with the foreign affairs experts and committee members of the relevant national parliaments, and then a lot of others, including now those who, there are voices speaking out, because it's a self-selection process, and those, what they're going to do more, as you just said, Roger, that's the question. It's a personal question for all of us, how much we're going to do every day. But this is going on that side of the Atlantic. And let me ask Alicia here on this side again. It seems to me that it's like you've been turning over a rock and all the crap is showing underneath, whether it's the fact... On a one-dimensional level, what the hell's the United States doing backing these Nazi groups in the streets causing blood in Kiev and elsewhere in Ukraine? Okay. But many people didn't... I know that people we've been reaching in the United States you could call them constituency groups, labor leaders, state legislators. They say, holy cow, I didn't know. I saw on TV and it was presented exactly opposite of what you just said, as if it's the government causing the problem. But one thing is, I think the effort of LaRouche Political Action Committee and others is to turn the rock over and expose this to the sunlight is really having an effect. I'm thinking, Alicia, if you have more to say about it, but Helga Zepp LaRouche herself went one night this week. There was a World Affairs Council meeting in Washington, D.C. Its panel, I think, was set up as a platform for the dirty British Empire intervention to support what's going on in to destabilize Ukraine. And one woman from the National Endowment for Democracy, her name is Nadia Dayuk, I believe, she just, Helga Zepp LaRouche caught her out and said, look, this is part of encirclement of Russia. It's creating the conditions for provoking war. And this Nadia Dayuk said, oh, I've never heard of encirclement. It's like saying, I've never heard of the ballistic missile installations in Poland. I've never heard of any of this. Well, it's just too much. Do you know more about this? Or you're doing that kind of thing, I presume, every day.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of effort is put into creating, you know, what they refer to as a narrative in Washington, D.C., you know, in any major city, you know, that you have to stick to, you know, that there's an agenda. These are the topics that are relevant. This is what we're going to focus on. And this is the culture in Washington, D.C. You have a lot of think tanks that churn out policy that has very little to do with the real world and needs of 7 billion people, but has everything to do with an agenda of particular interests that have taken over the United States over the last 30 or 40 years. And this, in a situation like Ukraine, or the challenges of the global financial system finally coming down as it lawfully always was going to, these situations really challenge this quote-unquote narrative, you know, that has, at least in my political career, spanned two presidencies. It's obviously gone on much further than that, of, you know, military intervention, bailing out Wall Street banks. You know, this is all coming apart right now, and the only muscle that the people, you know, pushing this agenda in Washington, D.C. and who are running the Obama administration, the only muscle they have is really just sort of brutal, beat you up, go with it, arm twisting type of stuff, and you know, thuggery to members of Congress. Hey, you don't want to be caught on the wrong side of this thing. I mean, when we were handing out the fact sheet in the halls of Congress on Wednesday, we just happened to run into a whole delegation of Ukrainians who were there, who were going 110% on the pure emotional value of, oh, we're victims, oh, we have this oppressive government, he should be overthrown, we need your help, West, you know, where are you coming from? So there's a lot of, and that's how you know that there's something funny going on, that there are interests other than the Ukrainians, you know, for the Ukrainian people and that region of the world at play. And that's really been our job in Washington, is to take this on in the Congress, the halls of Congress itself, but also make these interventions at these think tanks and bring reality. I mean, the reality of the simple economic reality that Ukraine faces right now is an obvious one. And just by omission, these various events that are highlighting the Ukraine situation can get away with saying a lot, you know, about what's in the best interest of these guys. They'll never mention the fact that, you know, the southern European countries are literally being killed by Troika austerity measures, and that the life expectancy rate is collapsing in half of Europe. They'll never mention that. That's what we've been doing. We've been bringing that to bear, and it's a battle. It's a blow by blow. It's changing by the hour, and to a certain degree, it emboldens others, and I think that's what happened with Helga's intervention. It emboldened others who who didn't want to believe, didn't want to take this crap, because people know it's an agenda.
You mean the attendees there, I understand.
Yeah.
Truth suddenly gets spoken.
Yeah, exactly. And another one of our organizers that happened Wednesday of this week as well, Leandra Bernstein, was at an event and did the exact same thing, laid out the situation, and people from different countries that were attending the event came up and gave her a card and said, "We completely agree with your analysis. You know, where did you come from? We want to hear more of it." So, you know, to the degree that we can challenge the Obama administration and the forces that are running the show here, then we're gaining ground, and I think we're emboldening members of Congress to do the same thing. But it's ugly. I mean, these guys are going for broke. This is something that Mr. LaRouche continues to reiterate, is that, you know, there's this long-standing pact of empire that, you know, we'd rather be dead than defeated. So, and people, really, Americans have to understand that that's what we are up against, and that's what, when we founded the United States and declared our independence, that was understood by the founders. And if we expect we can get by with anything less, then we're not going to make it, because that empire still does exist today, and that's, they really are going for broke right now.
Yeah, just for people listening, you will be familiar with LaRouchePub.com, but in the January 17 issue of EIR is a rundown of not just Greece, Spain, Portugal, Cyprus, of the increase in suicides, death rates, harm, but other countries from East Europe who have joined the EU, like Poland, joined in 2004, their coal mining operations have unemployed more than 75% of their workforce. Lithuania's livestock cut by 75% because it all violated some. It's all part of what it means to join the EU, and this is so. Have a look at that. This what I'm describing was prepared by an advisor to Putin named Sergei Glazyev, who recently did another expose just this week on how many millions of dollars, U.S. dollars, maybe 20 million a week, going to the different NGOs. There's something like 2,000 NGOs, clubs, political organizations in Ukraine to destabilize the place.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to give some informational briefing here, but we really have it's very stark, but of course it's war, or it's either peace or obliteration that's at stake here. And from that point of view, let me ask you, Alicia, or you, Roger, but let me start with Alicia.
Can I just say something about Glazyev?
Oh, yeah, go right ahead. Quickly.
Yeah, because, you know, he said what we've reported on what you mentioned. But, you know, aside from the Nazis and the U.S. money and presumably the EU money that we know about going in there, the nature of the groups that provoked it, he called it a coup d'etat. And he made a point, this wasn't rhetoric on his part, this was international law and strategic relations. He said under international law, this fulfilled, what they were doing, fulfilled the requirements of a coup d'etat. And then he mentioned something, and this was more, in my opinion, addressed to the United States. He said, the United States, also Britain and Russia, in 1994, settled the question of the nuclear weapons that were still present and nuclear delivery systems that were still present in independent Ukraine after the breakup of the Soviet Union. And there was an agreement, and then there was a memorandum to the agreement. The agreement basically said, okay, we dismantle all the nuclear weapons. And then the Ukrainians said, hold on, we want guarantees in the context of taking away our nuclear deterrent, or whatever they might have called it. And then that became what was known as the Budapest Memorandum, colloquially as the Budapest Memorandum. And that's what Sergei Glazyev said. He said, because the press played up, oh, the Russians are getting ready to invade Ukraine. You know, they have a military base in Sevastopol on the Black Sea port, which is Ukraine, but it's a Russian military base. And then all the industry in the eastern Ukraine is very much tied to the Russian economy historically and to this day, and the Russians are making efforts to modernize that. Dmitry Rogozin, the former ambassador to NATO and who's a senior advisor to Putin, was there talking about aerospace, et cetera, et cetera. So that's going on. But what Glaziev emphasized, he says, the United States and we are co-signatories to upholding the sovereignty of Ukraine. And Pino Alarki says, what are we doing violating the sovereignty of Ukraine? And other people are thinking that, and certainly the Russians are thinking that. But his point was, we have what is de facto, and you know, the lawyers can debate on this, but the content of it is, we had an agreement with you and the United States not to mess around with the sovereignty and security of Ukraine. And you, we've caught you, and also the Europeans, but he emphasized the U.S. because he was addressing the U.S. He's not this is not just scoring propaganda points. He's saying, we had an agreement with you called the Budapest Memorandum in 1994, and that has been violated by a coup d'etat, an effort that would probably lead to the split and the de facto ending of the integrity of the Ukraine as a country. So where are you in upholding this? And this is very, I think this is something we should very much use, not the technicalities of the memorandum per se, but that's what Glaziev was saying. He's a top-level advisor to Putin. We happen to have translated his book back in the 1990s, Genocide, about what globalization did to Russia. So I think, you know, if we can get back to Admiral Stavridis in a December interview in Foreign Policy, he was the former head of the European Command, not far from Wiesbaden, down in Stuttgart, U.S. Military forces here in Europe. He had a lot of dealings with the Russian because he was also the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, which is the traditional relationship, and he had a lot of dealings with the Chief of Staff of the Russian Army. And he came out, and despite all the little flaky problems he might have, he's now retired, he said we have to cooperate with the Russians. So I would hope that as this, not just a messy, stupid attack on Syria, or the extremely messy consequences of an attack of the Israelis on Iran, where we have to back up the Israelis, and we get into another schlamazel, so to speak, of death and destruction and destroyed countries and regions. But he's saying the issue is actually Russia. If we cooperate with Russia, we can solve problems, as is partially going on with Geneva II and with Iran. And now we have to get that effect, but with the urgency of the weeks and months, if we're lucky with months, before this goes up to the brink. And I think, and I would hope, that which you saw there better than I did here, that we saw here, but we saw the effects of it. And Europeans don't know why suddenly the attack on Syria was called off. I mean, there were headlines, and you know, the Obama said, "Oh, I'm going to go to Congress, but I still want to do it, but I'm going to go to Congress," and then it didn't happen. And then suddenly Lavrov came and made his offer to the United States on Syria and then Iran. But they don't know why it happened. And it's been very useful to me, and that's been my entry point when speaking with German military and other people, is I speak there as a representative of the revolt that went on successfully up to a limited point to stop the escalation that could have gone on and was planned to go on around Syria and then Iran, or Iran then Syria, however you want to represent it, last year. And people were extremely curious to know, what is this, what happened in the U.S. that it didn't happen? Because it was like, it's just easy for the U.S. to go out and bomb something, and okay, they're going to bomb it again, it's going to create a mess. They didn't think more profoundly about it. But suddenly it didn't happen, and they don't know why it didn't happen. And I think we know in the U.S., and hopefully we can get that echo of that going under the immediate urgency of something that's much more devastating than what would have been the short-term consequences of Syria. So I think Glaziev and the Russians know that, whatever they say or don't say, that what they concerns them. And remember Putin's New York Times article back in September, as it was really hot on the potential attack, he had this op-ed in there, and he says, look, we've worked together in history, let's do it again, don't make a mistake. I mean, I forget the details of his op-ed, and people said, oh, this is Putin just tooting his horn. But, I mean, it was a very conscious effort to intervene and call up reason and better traditions of United States and Russian relations, and there are many of them. And one of them, let me just mention it quickly, the Crimean War. This was the area of Ukraine around the Black Sea. 1856, I think it ended. The Russians know their history. They know their history about Stefan Bandera and the Nazis and the Ukrainian fascists in 1941. But they also know their history of the British Empire and the Crimean War. And this was a czar, a British-French Ottoman Empire, but British and French war against Russia in the area of what is now called Ukraine. And the famous battle at Sevastopol. And that's a very deep memory in Russian history, particularly the Russian attitude about the British Empire. And I think that might be something that might be a bit too much for people who don't know history, both here in Europe and the U.S. But remember, the Civil War was a part of what could have become a world war. And the only reason it didn't become a world war is because Lincoln's leadership, plus the intervention of the Russian fleet in 1863, at the point the British and the French were getting ready to join and intervene militarily in the American Civil War that was raging in the 1860s. And out of the Crimean War, the Russians have an historical sense of the British Empire under Alexander II and his foreign minister Gorbachev. And Gorbachev was in intense communications with Lincoln, as best as they could be carried at that time, and sent the Russian fleet to the Pacific coast and to the east coast of the United States, and said it would be a casus belli. So there's a history of the United States working with Russia to deal with all these, the British Empire.
I want to reiterate what you're saying, Roger, because that couldn't be closer to the truth. That viewers should, or listeners should, think about exactly what you just laid out and realize that there is no fundamental disagreement between the United States and Russia, and that it's not a coincidence that the world's two major superpowers are being pit against each other for a confrontation at a time when they have so much common cause to work together. And that is the footprint, that is the intentional policy. That's how you know you're dealing with empire, that it's alive and well, and that the best flanking maneuver we could run is massive agreements and cooperation with Russia on so many fronts, including anti-narcotics, anti-terrorism, the defense of Earth, the development of fusion power. I mean, we have so much common cause with this other nation, and real patriots in both nations and in nations in between should begin, as Mr. LaRouche mentioned this morning in a meeting with associates, to outsmart their enemy, not out brute force them, but outsmart them. And this is the best thing that we could do. I just want to make one last pitch. I know we're running out of time, but
go ahead.
I really want to encourage people to call their Congress members and communicate this to them in the best way that they can. The Capitol switchboard number, if you don't have it handy already in your phone, is 202-224-3121. 202-224-3121. Just call, get your Congress member's number, your senator's number, and tell them that they've got to get privy to the larger strategic implications of what's going on, and that these are the grounds for Obama's impeachment. It may not be the reason why we do it, you know, officially. It can be for whatever, you know. There's many things we could say, but the Congress has to disarm the United States and pull us out of a potential third world war, which would be a thermonuclear war.
Yeah, just in closing, I know I remember the time, I think it was a Saturday, when Obama announced, we're prepared to intervene in Syria, we're prepared to intervene with bombs, it doesn't matter what he said about boots on or off the ground. And the Congress, we surveyed, looked at the calls started going into the congressman's offices.
Oh, we were there. You should have walking through the halls. These secretaries, the poor young men and women sitting at the desk, were exhausted. And this was at lunchtime. I mean, every office we walked into, the phones were ringing off the hook. And it was all the same thing. Don't go into Syria. It was quite phenomenal.
Right. And the thing is, it's every person who isn't a complete day trader, third generation, has a friend or otherwise who's lost an arm, a leg, a head, is dead, and so when soon as the president said we're going to go and intervene, people said no. Now, the recent apparent muddle of all the stations, CNN, BBC, everyone else saying it's we have to save the people of Ukraine against the government, against Russia, It's a muddle, but the underlying response, with the right leadership, that's what you're saying, with individuals acting, we can change. We can stop the dynamic, and we don't have more time on this show, but one of the manifestations of with the right leadership, we can head off this, stop this countdown to war, is this surge again among state legislatures to strike a heart on Wall Street with Glass-Steagall. There are now about, I might get it wrong, at least five states I can think of that have active action on the Glass-Steagall resolution on the state level. And that includes Maryland, Washington, Arizona, Alabama, Virginia, New Mexico. And as I say, that's for people to follow and give lead the charge with day by day. But thank you so much for being on and giving this direct report. So that's Roger Moore in Germany. We have to sign off. And Alicia Serratani here in Washington, D.C. So this will be the end for February 8th, 2014, The LaRue Show. Thank you all very much.
Thank you both.